Hi-de-ho, Slashers and Survivor Girls. Welcome to another edition of the Creepin' It Real Horror Cast, the sick edition.
Mm-hmm.
If I sound a little husky, fuzzy, froggy, whatever adjective you'd like to use for a not-so-quite-right-sounding voice box, it's because I've been fighting off a sinus thing. Infection? Question mark? Maybe? All week? I'm actually shocked to see, to hear that my voice is held out this long, mm-hmm. but I have a feeling by the time we're done recording this, it's going to give out, so let's not make this one a super long one, please. I'd like to have a voice.
But welcome back, everybody. We're happy to have you. Love you.
Love.
But I'm that good buddy Lunchbox.
Oh, yeah, I'm Mistress Meg.
Hey, that's who that is.
And over there. The good buddy Lunchbox is also fighting off a sinus something or other.
Oh, 100%. It's a coming. It's just making its way, just creeping in, it's doing that thing where it like it opens the door slightly just to see, like, hey, you there? Can I come in? No. Okay, I'll wait just 1 second, and then it's there. It's just yeah. You know.
I've been all week. hasn't been enough to lay me out. Like, I haven't been sick enough for it to take me down. I'm still functioning, but it's just enough to be annoying.
But that's the worst, is like...
Just either lay me out or leave me alone.
Yeah, because you know that your body is just basically telling you everything. There's just a whole basket of fuckets just waiting with your name on it. And yet the rest of, like, your actual, like, responsibilities and everything else is just like... No, you're okay enough to do whatever we need you to do.
You still have to human. So, enough about that bullshit. If you haven't done it yet and we haven't chased you off with that babble,
mm-hmm.
join us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, at Creepin' It Real. R-E-E-L is movie reel. Also, make sure you subscribe. We drop in your favorite podcatcher on Tuesdays. I think this one's going to go out on
time. It is going to get there and get done.
Okay, so if you're listening to this the day it drops, it should be a Tuesday.
Yes, ma'am.
You can email us at creepinitreal.cm@gmail.com. And you can buy our merch at creepinitreal.redbubble.com. There's also a link if you want to tap that in the Instagram bio that brings you directly to that landing page.
And this should be our week of Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving, everybody, because this will be our Thanksgiving episode, technically, all the nom-nom-noms.
Yeah, right? Didn't we do this a couple years ago? We did a zombie month for...
Yep.
We did.
We sure did.
Because it felt right.
Yeah. I mean, when you have to, like, overeat and just pig out, and, yeah, it's, you know, zombie movies are always the way to go, for sure.
Right.
And I'm actually wearing my Cannibal Corpse t-shirt.
That no one can see. Except me.
But yeah, so you can confirm it.
They can't see it with their ears, Craig.
But it's a pretty sweet shirt. It's actually one of my favorite shirts. It fits me so nicely.
Aw.
I like it. And it's death metal. I freaked someone out the other day. I was walking out of Walmart, and the guy was like, hey, what's that band shirt? And I was like... Oh, no, I was wearing my cattle decapitation hoodie, and he couldn't read the logo. I was like, yeah, it's cattle decapitation. He's like, oh, and immediately retreated away from talking to me. And I was just like, yes.
Yes, because the the vegan core band is so scary.
I know.
Like, so scary.
I was like, I got cattle decapitation under here. You want to keep on? Let's go, buddy.
Right. So, yes. The Zeds. We're continuing on with the Zeds and the Of the Dead series, trucking along with George Romero. This week we've done Land of the Dead.
Mm. Now that we actually got into what we're doing, geez.
It took us under 5 minutes to get there, so we got there.
Oh, buckle up.
Yeah. Isn't it fun when we're loopy?
Oh, yeah.
There's a reason why I didn't take any cold medicine before we did this, because I needed to try to keep my wits about me.
I kind of would prefer it not to be that way. That'd be fun.
I could have done the Scottish cold remedy.
Yeah, that'd be cool too. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I usually do the redneck version of it.
Yeah, no, the Scottish cold remedy is warm whiskey, lemon, and honey.
Yeah, well, me minus the moonshine, but you know.
right. Yeah. Sub out moonshine for whiskey.
Yep.
Land of the Dead. So George Romero decided to take a 20-year break from filming the Zeds.
Didn't he take like a 20, like it was a, like a really long time, it felt like, where we ever saw a Romero movie. Like,
I don't think he took a break from making movies. I'd have to look into that. I'm not 100% sure. I know I think he had at least one thing drop during the 90s.
Well, but I mean, didn't he do like the Masters of Horror stuff too? Like,
he did a little bit of that, yeah.
I have to double check that, but yeah.
You know, he did some stuff. It just, he didn't do any of the Dead movies. It was a 20-year gap between Day of the Dead and Land of the Dead. The latter dropped on June 24th, 2005. It was made for a budget of approximately $15 million. It ended up grossing about $47.1 million worldwide. So, not great, but not bad, considering a lot of his movies don't really gross anything in the box office anyway.
That tends to be, like, one of the things that always kind of pops up when it comes to a Romero movie, is that he made it for nothing and didn't have any money to really spend, or, and he didn't really make any money from it. I was like, so, I mean, I guess it's like the whole thing is like, eh, just do what you love and, you know, for art's sake. But it's just like, it's just really funny that it always tends to pop up with that conversation.
The unfortunate thing about Romero, and we'll probably get into this more at some point, is the unfortunate thing about Romero, I think, is that he tends to have a very niche audience. Like, he has a core set of people who are gonna go see his films no matter what. But he doesn't necessarily pull people in from the outside to go to the theater. He seems to do more, he makes more traction with at home, with at the time, the disc releases, mm-hmm. The home video releases. So, like, he always seemed to do better with that than he did getting butts in movie theater seats.
Yeah.
It's more culty.
Yeah, I could definitely see it being more of a, but, and, yeah, definitely culty for sure, but I almost wonder, is it better to be in that cult following, or would you rather it be somebody like a Steven Spielberg, where it's just that so name mainstream. Is just, yeah, it's like, or James Cameron. It's
honestly,
like, you know, I don't know, it's
in that sort of discussion, because I'd rather be an auteur that makes money than a guy who doesn't. And that's cool. They, you know, you want to turn out product, and Lloyd Kaufman has made a life, he's built an entire empire on just making movies for himself and for his core audience with Trauma.
Trauma, yeah.
That's for the best one. But
God, I love the Toxic Avenger.
But on the other side of that, Steven Spielberg has done the exact same thing on a bigger scale, where he's kind of done his own thing. He's got a lot of pull with the movie movie production companies. Like, he's got enough stroke to be like, I'm making a movie, and people just start flinging money at him.
Yeah.
So I would rather be the Spielberg, to be totally honest, because I am a capitalist at heart. But you know, if you can churn out a good art and make money off of it, I mean, really?
Yeah. No, it's just one of those things where, like, I guess the punk rock side of me comes out, where it's like, oh, you gotta just, you know, do it for your art, do it just because it's something that you love, and
yeah, but why not turn that something you love into a money-making product?
Oh, I don't care what kind of punk band, it's like, you're not just gonna just do it just, I just want to play in the grungiest places because, you know, like, no, it's like, you're out, there is a little piece of it to make money just because you gotta eat, whatever it is. But at the same time, it's just one of those where, for somebody like a Romero, or I'm trying to think of another really good kind of cult, like a Sam Raimi or something, like, you know, or like with like Evil Dead and things,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, I mean, Raimi once upon a time could have been in that conversation, but because he's worked, He's done some humongous mainstream movies. He just put out a movie for the MCU.
Yeah. And I'm saying, like, but, like, back in the day.
Raimi 30 years ago? Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. It's like, so now it's like whenever you hear the word Evil Dead, it's usually within convention, you know, fandom. It's just, it's all word of mouth type of thing where it's like, oh my God, you need to go see that movie even though it's been, you know, years and years and years past. So it's like, I like that. I think if you can have that type of like cult following is going to be more beneficial for you long run than being just the dude that's like, you know, big blockbuster guy. Yeah, you're making a lot of money, but it's like, I don't know.
For me, I don't think so, because the problem with the cult audiences is if you don't constantly pander to them.
Yeah,
that and does you make decide sense. You want to try something different, you'll lose them almost instantly.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of them don't. Yeah. They're attached to your product and your art because that is the thing that appeals to them most. If you have an artist who paints, who paints in watercolor, suddenly decides, you know what, I want to try pottery. No, that's the same idea. Like Romero's most famous movies are the zombie films. Like, yeah, there's the Crazies, and there's Creepshow, and there's Martin, and there's other ones out there, but his bread-and-butter movies are those. The other things he's done on the peripheral of the Dead films...
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Like, I didn't really even think about it that way.
Think about it. Like, how many...
100%. Like as you're telling me, I'm like... I know so many people that are like that.
You want to use a music analogy, how many fucking metalheads get all bent out of shape because their favorite band goes, you know what? I want to try to spice this up a little bit. Let's change this up a little and like maybe tune our guitars a little different, or maybe play something with a different melody or whatever. Like anytime, especially in heavy metal, when a band changes their sound, this is the worst thing that has ever assaulted my ears. Oh my God. Like it's a whole, so dramatic. And it's the same thing with those cults horror fans for their movies. And they're very protective of their movies. So if anybody ever says, you know, that was fine, I guess, but it really wasn't my thing, or I didn't like it because of XYZ reasons, they're usually the first to turn and bite.
I mean, we saw a lot of that with the latest Halloween movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just like, oh, like, I mean, granted, it's like, yeah, there was stuff that I could agree with them on where, you know, just, but it was definitely that where it was a lot of the really, really negative stuff that I saw online was, you could tell, like, these people were I'm the Uber fan and I need what I want. Give me what I want. I was like, this is like, and it was just, it almost kind of felt like a little entitled, and it just was.
That's 100% what it is.
Yeah. So I totally agree with that. And like with Romero, it's interesting because I think, didn't he step away from, it was after, I believe, Dawn of the Dead, he stepped away from the zombie stuff because he didn't want to be typecast into those type of movies. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, no, like, that is what you are best at. And it's just like, go do those.
Yeah, because he made, in between Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead, he had made Creepshow. I think it was called Knight Rider. It was Knights on Motorcycles or something. It was really fucking stupid. But it was after the Knights on Motorcycles movie, he went and decided, okay, I'm going to go back and do another Of the Dead film. And then he did some stuff in between, but it was 20 years between Day of the Dead and Land of the Dead, which was he had taken some gaps prior to that. It was 10 years between Night and Dawn. It was 7 years between Dawn and Day. And then it was 20 years between Day and Land. And then I think, what came next? Diary of the Dead or Survival of the Dead?
It was Survival.
And Survival of the Dead was 10 years after that, and then Diary of the Dead was only like 3 or 4 years after that. That was the shortest gap was between those movies. And Land of the Dead starred Simon Baker as Riley, John Leguizamo as Cholo, Dennis Hopper as Kaufman, Asia Argento as Slack, Robert Joy as Charlie, Eugene Clark as Big Daddy. And then there are a couple of notable cameos from Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg in a couple of scenes and on the movie poster, actually. They're pretty much right bang in the center of the movie poster.
Yeah. Yeah, right there with Big Daddy.
So this is a natural... one of the things I appreciated about Land of the Dead is this is a natural continuation from Day of the Dead. It took... And I think that's one of the things that Romero has done well throughout the series, whether the movies themselves hung together. One thing that he did particularly well was he was able to pick up the thread of the last film and then expand on it.
Yeah. And expand on it within a different realm. Like, so he took a whole nother section of things that are happening, mm-hmm. and just...
And expanded it outward. Expanded on the ideas, the seeds he planted in the previous film had bared fruit at that point by the time the next one rolled around. Romero is very, very good at that. One of the things we look at in some of the... Like, you can see in a lot of the major horror franchises, Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, Friday the 13th, etc., one of the things that is notable about those is that because there is no singular voice in any of those, whoever picks up for the next film, whoever, writer, director, what have you, picks up for the next film, can just say, nah, fuck it, to the last one. We saw that with Halloween 4 and 5. Like, the end of Halloween 4 was a huge... It was a really cool setup where you're looking at, oh my God, the torch is being passed to Jamie Lloyd. They did it in a really good way. It's like, oh man, where could they potentially take this? And then the writers and directors for Halloween 5 went, that's nice, and wanted nothing to do with it. And they, and in a lot of those movie series, what happens is the subsequent sequels end up making, kind of ruining the prior movie a little bit because they just sort of, they find some half-baked reason to bring back the killer, or they just do something stupid with it, completely fumble the ball with any setup that might have been done in the prior film. And Romero doesn't do that, at least so far. I've never seen Survival of the Dead or Diary of the Dead, so I don't know if he keeps that going through the last two movies, yeah. But up till this point, he's done a pretty good job of taking these... building layers on top of what he started the movie before.
And that was something where I think because it is his baby, he is able to take that idea of whatever he's written and so it's different when you have, like, as you said, where you get like the different directors, different writers, different producers, like with too many hands in the pot and shit goes. One of our other favorites is Child's Play.
Yep.
And, you know, he just take he just takes it on because it's his project.
Yeah, for good or bad. And outside of the changes that Tom Holland and John Lafia had made in Child's Play 1.
Yeah.
Outside of the changes made there, which Don Mancini has done a pretty fair job of adapting into the scripts going forward. Again, for good or for bad.
Yeah.
Seat of Chucky. He's continued on, but it's been a singular mind, basically a singular mind, a singular voice as the writer, and then somebody else was directing that movie, whether it was Tom Holland, Ronnie Yu, whomever, to Don Mancini himself, who's, since Seed of Chucky, has done everything on his own. He's been the writer-director. And Romero has been that from the start. Since Night of the Living Dead in 1968, it's been the George Romero show.
Yeah. I mean, hell, even in the whole... from our last episode with the remake and Tom Savini, it was the same thing where he was just there and they were using the bones of what he did. So it's kind of like it still felt Romero-esque, but with a very updated and gory and just, so a very Tom Savini-esque feel to it.
Sure.
So,
nice that they had maintained. I mean, I don't think we talked about this last week, but like they had maintained the skeleton of the original film, which is, like you said, and it's super important to do that. Even with a remake, you want it to still be kind of recognizable for what it's supposed to be working off of, whatever that adaptation is. And Land of the Dead, I think, takes what was started in Day of the Dead was this idea that the brain of these zombies, of the ghouls, whatever you want to call them, the Zeds, had somehow started to knit back together. You were getting some neural regeneration where, and Bub was sort of the patient zero of that idea with recognizing things that they had dealt with when they were alive, with being able to kind of look at common tools or objects and recognize them and know what they're for. Bub picks up a razor. He can't use it well, but he knows what it's for, and he goes through the motions, and you see him scrape it across his face. The book, I mean, he might not necessarily know how to read the words on the page, but he gets the concept of how a book works. And then in Land of the Dead, we extrapolate that out further, so now it's not just one, it's an entire community of these creatures who have sort of stumbled into just a regular life. Yeah, they're still flesh eaters. Yeah, they're still kind of monstrous, but you have Big Daddy who's still doing the gas station thing, and you have there was the ones in the gazebo who were trying to play their instruments. So awesome. I mean, again, they don't have the motor skills to actually do these things correctly or do them well, but they're going through the motions of things that they used to do. There was a zombie couple, and like, so there's all of these things that are building off of this idea that, okay, yeah, they might be dead, but maybe something's going on. Maybe there's something more at work here with the brains than just these driven by the idea of these things being driven by blood.
Yeah, I had this thought of how that would kind of like, or going back to like Frankenstein's whole thought process from Day of the Dead, where yeah, like they're remembering and they can learn and they can behave and we could be taught and all that good shit. Mm-hmm. But it's, I wonder if, depending on where they were bitten or how they died, I wonder if that also has some type of an effect as to the speed of whatever they're doing. Because later on in the movie, I mean, we get one of our characters, he ends up dying, comes back, but it's like instant. He knows exactly how to work a weapon. Like, he knows exactly who he's going after. So he is freshly dead. And it's one of but all the other Zeds that we see in the movie, they have been dead for a while. Like, it is rough on some of them. They're just decrepit. They're just sunken in. Like, it's, I mean, they literally, like, you touch them and yeah, fucking arm falls off. Like, it's, yeah.
Blade had been dead at that point for almost 30 years.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
We get a sweet little cameo of Tom Savini dressed up as Blade from Dawn of the Dead. He somehow has survived getting picked off by all the hunting parties, and he shows up
with his machete.
Yeah, he traveled all the way to Fiddler's Green from Monroeville.
Yeah.
So, I mean, good on him.
I was like, oh, we totally, I know we mentioned about Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright, which, awesome zombies, by the way. Like, they were good
looking. They were in the club, weren't they?
They were at the fire pit. There's a girl who was screaming, and they were trying to, like, they were all chained up. Oh, they were, like,
taking the pictures.
Yeah, they were they were doing the photo ops. Like, and so that was all really cool. All
because George Romero really loved Shaun of the Dead.
I know, it's so good. But
can you imagine being those two? The whole reason they did Shaun of the Dead was as an homage to Romero's movies.
Oh,
like,
God, yeah.
They had to have been, like, tickled to death.
See, now, my thing is, I'm kind of bummed that they didn't get Nick Frost. Like, to have all three of them there, that would be...
Especially if he wears Got Wood t-shirt.
Yes, the whole Got, like, just do Zombie Ed, like, that would be cool. Wouldn't make a whole lot of sense, I mean, because that's technically Ed from Sean. You know, England, yeah. But it's just like, yeah.
It would have been a fun little Easter egg.
That would have been cool. But yeah, seeing Tom Savini just come in and just give a couple of hack and slash and then just... And he had that same Blade energy. Like, it was the... Like, he's ready to go. Like, he's, you know, jumping around, looking around for the next victim.
It was intense, yeah.
Whereas, I think all the other zombies, they didn't have that... They had that very just sluggish, we're going to go do our thing.
Yeah.
He was the only one that was just like, whoop, good, let's go. So that was something where I almost feel like depending on how you died or where you were bitten or, you know, what the cause of that, I wonder if that would push the development of whatever they were doing. With Big Daddy, it's like we don't actually see, one, how he died or what it was, but he seemed that he was fully, like, functional. Like, I don't think he was, like, seriously injured enough to the point of being, like he was bitten, like, really badly or anything. Maybe he died of a heart attack or something. I mean, but
Big Daddy was probably bitten somewhere. All of them, all the Zeds in their little town there had been bitten and injured by a different zombie, but like I don't know, man, like most of them seem to be fairly intact. There was the one, I think it was the cheerleader one,
yeah,
where the mouth ripped open. It's a cool idea. It didn't translate well.
Really? I liked it.
Now, because I have a 4K TV, it doesn't look great in that level of high def.
I don't know, like, I...
Because you can see the teeth on the outside, and you can see, like, how the makeup was done, and this wasn't... One of the things you can praise about this film, too, about Land of the Dead, is they didn't use a ton of... They weren't heavy-handed with the CGI. There was a tiny bit, but it was used as, like, an enhancement. It wasn't, like, the whole thing. But, like, yeah, the cheerleader with the ripped open mouth where you're supposed to be able, like Two-Face from The Dark Knight, see inside of her mouth. The close-ups of that, I'm sure, look great prior to high-def TVs. Yeah. But now it's a little, like, it's just because the way it lays.
I still go back to, okay, put zombie cheerleader next to a zombie from Dawn of the Dead.
You got me.
It's like, come on. It's like this. Like, she looked fucking great. All the zombies looked awesome. Like, even the ones that just were, that looked like Crypt Keeper. Like, it was just, they looked great. They had, and I love that they also had a personality, which was a weird thing to, because most of the time when you get a zombie movie, it's just zombie. Like, even though you're dressed a certain way,
you're just shuffling zombie. Undead.
Like, one of my favorites is Butcher. So, the guy, he had the cleaver, and he's walking, like, he's just kind of going along, and he's following Big Daddy, but he's kind of, like, number two.
Yeah, that's
like
what I was thinking.
And so, that like, he's just there, and then when Big Daddy, like, there's a part where there's a big, like, wooden wall, and Big Daddy turns around, and he just takes the cleaver from him. Or not from him, but then he, like, puts his hand and then kind of shows him what to do and then smacks the wall and says, you know, here. And Butcher starts going to town and opening up the wall. And I was just like, and then there's, like, all, you always kind of get that little group of, that is Big Daddy's army. And that is something that was really interesting to see where they do communicate and they have, as you said, that little type of community, and they were able to kind of interact with each other to a degree.
They weren't,
but not like that socially, but they were able to.
No, they didn't have speech.
No.
But they had a language, and Big Daddy was clearly the most with it of all of them, which is why he was able to step up into that sort of leader role. Because he was the one who was most with it.
Yeah.
And the rest of them eventually, once they sort of, they did like a, they almost organized. I would say they organized themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when they were run out by the Cholo and his crew. They were running around causing trouble, and all of the raiders had gone into that part of town to get supplies and stuff. Big Daddy was the one who paid attention to which direction they were going in, and because normally they were distracted by the fireworks, and all of the other ones
which who... Which we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah, but all the other ones who weren't... They were still much more simple-minded, were staring off at the fireworks, and Big Daddy was trying to shake them out of it. And, because he knew it was a trick, but he's the one who paid attention to which way the vehicles were going. He's the one that said, did, kind of rallied everybody and said, okay, fuck it, let's go. He's the one who figured out that we might not have to, we don't have to swim, but we can't breathe, we don't breathe underwater, or we don't need to breathe. So he's the one who figured out they can just walk underwater and not have to worry about it. Like, he was, for a dead guy, he was much more intelligent than a lot of living people I actually know, because he was willing, he would test.
Yeah.
He would test and step, like, he would test and step back, test and step back. And he was the, Big Daddy was the one who was like, oh, okay, so it's okay if we can do this. He's the one who got his hands on a gun. He's the one who organized the troops. He's the one who led them in the battle. He's the one who was, even when Cholo and his crew were rolling through and causing trouble, like, he's the one trying to pull people out of the way of...
That was so crazy.
The vehicles and stuff, so they wouldn't get hurt.
He saved a zombie child.
Yeah.
Like, they were starting to shoot, and he was like, ah, and then just... pushes the shit out of her, but then he ends up, like, he's trying to get around, like, all the other guys to get away, get down, mm-hmm. and he ends up grabbing one of the zombies' heads, and Cholo, or one of Cholo's guys, shoots or a whole messload of bullets, and it severs the head of the zombie, and Big Daddy's just sitting there holding it, and then they start, the sky flowers and the it, like, so all the fireworks are going off, and the zombie head is staring up like he can't get away from it. I was like, so I thought that was really cool. Oh, and then Big Daddy putting the head back on the ground and then stomping the shit out of it as like a mercy killing. Like,
yeah, because the brain hadn't been damaged, so the head, even though it wasn't attached to the body anymore, was still moving, was still kind of, like, quote-unquote, alive. The fact that there's a dead guy, Big Daddy, he had enough going on inside of his brain to recognize that this was inhumane, and the better option would be to just go ahead and kill this poor decapitated man. Like, you wouldn't... Back during Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, that was not an option. No. That was not something you could see. But that was... This is like... They took... Romero took Bub and then turned him up to 11.
Yeah. And seeing, like, how they could do that. Because Bub is such a good character. Especially because it's a zombie that you care about. Like, you are attached to, and it having that thing with, like, Frankenstein, where you could kind of see why Frankenstein is so invested with him. And now it's like, when you see Big Daddy, it's you again, it's you actually care about what is going to happen, and you want him to succeed, but, in whatever they're doing.
But unlike Bub had this childlike charm to him. Because it was like watching a toddler learn how to use tools for the first time, right? So there's something...
Say hello, Aunt Alicia.
Yeah. So there's something charming about Bub that made him endearing. The difference with Big Daddy is, yes, he's Bub turned up to 11 in terms of having the brain power and the capacity to learn and all this other stuff. But he was picking things up so quickly that it was actually... really intimidating, and also in general size, he's a very large man.
Yeah.
Eugene Clark's a big dude, but Big Daddy, like, yes, he cut a, he was a big guy, but, like, this is the first time I've watched one of these where I was like, oh, this is an actual threat. Because before, like, in the Night of the Living Dead remake, you saw Barbara, she figured, she saw a thin spot. she could get through simply by knocking them out of the way. She didn't even have to shoot. She could just knock them down, and they were, like, turtle on their back for a minute before they could figure out how to roll back over and get up. But, like, Big Daddy being able to think and problem solve and do the things he was able to do, it kind of took me back, and I sat there for a second, and I was like, oh, this is a real problem. Because the humans in Fiddler's Green were all thinking they were safe and cozy inside their beds because everything was walled off and they had water on two sides and there was in and outs were only on bridges and all this other shit. They successfully built themselves a prison. And it never occurred to anybody that an evolution would occur.
No, and they're thinking that, like, oh, they see it day in and day out where, because they have, like, this military group that is on the perimeter. They have everything that is blocked off by a really crazy-ass, high-powered electric fence. And on top, like, so you have the water separating everything out. You have the crazy electrical fence. And then you also have, like I said, this military group with high-powered just machinery. Like, there's no way that, like, there was anything that was getting through there. There's just no thought process as to how these dumb, rotting things are just going to be able to overpower this group.
But then you've got the one guy in that group, in the dead guy group, who figures that, oh, we don't need to use the bridges. We can just go underwater. And then they can't see us. Because they're not breathing. There's no bubbles. They're deep enough that they're not making ripples on the surface of the water. It's game over, man.
You want to know what it reminded me of? Down Periscope.
Seriously?
Yeah, actually it did. Because in the movie, they have this whole war game where they send out, like, this whole fleet of nuclear subs, and then they get this one diesel sub to go in and infiltrate and try to, you know, hit, like, all the harbors and stuff like that in the simulation and whatnot. And it's fucking hilarious because it's just one of those, like, something that you would feel is, it's so old and rickety, and it still got by the best of your best. And
well, I'll be damned. You just compared this to Down Periscope.
Damn straight. Down Periscope is a gem. I love that movie.
Is that the new Jaws? Because you've managed to insert this into a couple of episodes.
No, it's just funny. It's like, well, I recently rewatched Down Periscope again with Adam's family. That was great. That was a good night. But,
it's a night full of giggles.
Oh my God, I love those movies. But, yeah, it was just funny that it was, like, after watching that, it, like, I don't know why it just, that concept just popped into my head. But with Big Daddy, the other zombies, you could tell that maybe they weren't as developed as Big Daddy was. However, they still were aware and they could still, they knew where danger was.
Yeah, and they had the animal instinct enough. It's like, Big Daddy was the predator. He was the lion. He was the problem solver, right? He was the one who was kind of, all the other Zeds were like Bub. They could kind of do some things with coaching and they could be led around but like Big Daddy evolved past that. So he's the predator. He's essentially the lion. The rest of them are all the prey. They're the herbivores. They're the gazelle. They're the ones, they just kind of run on instinct. Mostly they're like, okay, we sense danger. We need to go. Or they'll attack if they feel threatened enough. So they feel the need to attack, or they'll take direction to attack. Like the couple, when, Big Daddy saw, was it Riley?
Yeah.
And he called out to the couple and then pointed over to Riley and his guys, and the couple turned and started to go after them. Like, they can take direction. So that's kind of unnerving that you have a zombie general and all of his grunts just doing whatever they're told. It's a really cool idea, and it's one that I'm glad that Romero picked back up and expanded on it and made this interesting story out of.
And I like that you got the other side, where it wasn't just the thing of I mean, it's seeing Riley and his group and them dealing with all the shit with Fiddler's Green and the Richie Riches and all that other shit, but then actually seeing this community of zombies and this one zombie that's just like, I've had enough, doing something about it. Mm-hmm. And he takes it takes that charge. It's so good.
And that's the that's one of the other
care. You care about it. That's another thing, is that you actually care what those zombies are doing.
Right.
That is a huge thing.
That is a really big deal. And because in these other movies, they were just bodies. In all of the other movies, it's just they're a threat. They're a problem. They're bodies. So what Romero did in Land of the Dead that was also pretty clever is not only did he make the zombies intelligent, where, okay, their brains are starting to function as human again. Not, you know, it's very rudimentary, but it's happening. Romero also somehow painted the humans, which up until this point were fighting for their survival. They're the monsters. Yeah. They're the bad guys.
It's what Barbara said at the end of the Night of the Living Dead remake. She's like, they're us and we're them. Like, or, you know, it's a really, really hard thing to sit there and go, okay, did humanity completely just go out the fucking door? Or is there just an ounce of where we could all just kind of survive together? Or is it just kind of...
Well, considering that outside of the randos that lived in Fiddler's Green, with the raiding group, Riley and Cholo and all of them, it seemed as if the Zeds had more humanity than the humans did.
Yeah.
And you saw that in Big Daddy, and you saw that in some of the behavior, some of the other ones, where, you know, Big Daddy's pushing people out of the way and saving kids and all this other stuff, and he's the one leading the charge. But then you have this group, the Raiders, Kaufman's, which essentially they're Kaufman's group. Like, Kaufman's the big cheese of the whole thing.
Yeah, Kaufman's the head of Fiddler's Green. So, right. Yeah.
And he's got both Riley and Cholo in his back pocket. And even though they're free to go if they want to, which Riley is exercising, he's like, look, man, I got one more in me and then I'm out.
It's King Koopa, you know, bossing around Mario and Luigi.
Pretty much.
Anybody get that reference?
Because any millennials out there remember the Super Mario Brothers movie? Because we get John Leguizamo and Dennis Hopper
in the Super Mario movie, didn't it?
Yeah, but you have these people who are going out there. They don't see, and to a point, I understand why you don't see the Zeds as human anymore, because you can't. It's like a wild animal. You can't just assume they're not going to bite. Like, they're probably going to bite. And you have to treat that as such. Yes, they are a threat, but they have completely abandoned the idea that these are, or were, no, I had that right, are human beings.
Yeah.
Because now they're coming back around to the other side. And I could almost wager that Big Daddy, for example, like, he's almost to the point where you could have a sit down with him.
Yeah. I actually thought, if I had to get my little armchair writing, mm-hmm. you know, put my, you know,
your writer pants on,
my thinking hat on, I thought it would have been really cool to actually get a standoff with Riley and Big Daddy. Like somehow they, you know, during the fight or whatever it is, because all we see in the movie is Riley is looking through the binoculars and he sees Big Daddy walking up, you know, this little like pathway or whatever, and that's it. And then he's like, oh, they're just looking for a place of their own, and then they just walk off, and that's it. I thought it'd be cool. It's like if literally Big Daddy just stood in front of them and they just kind of understood. And then Big Daddy just turns and just walks away. Just doesn't, he doesn't go after Riley. He doesn't do anything. He just kind of like, they have an understanding. Riley says, go ahead. Like, we're, you know, sorry. Go do your thing. Like, this is, you know, we'll leave you alone type of thing. Like, we want to coexist, whatever it is. And, you know, I thought that would be kind of cool.
But the thing is like, Riley, like, for example, you could take that where Riley and Big Daddy can go, this is your space, this is my space, and we're just gonna coexist that way.
They high five, fist bump, right. You know, peace out.
It's like, here's the borderline, we have an understanding, they have their own half-assed Geneva Convention, and then call it a day. Like, yeah. Big Daddy is almost to that point. And Riley, it was nice having the Riley and the Cholo characters, because they were two guys on the same team that were on polar opposite sides of the thought process.
And I love, too, that Riley was that cop that was on the last day before retirement.
Yeah. It's just like, and I was like, wow, he uttered those words, I'm out of here in a couple days. I was like, that's usually a death sentence. Well, he was. He got out.
Barely.
But he got out. Didn't matter. He got to go do his thing with Asia Argento.
Yeah.
Fox.
Ooh.
She's so pretty.
Showing.
She played a prostitute.
She sure did.
Another Dario Argento connection. God damn it, Romero. this time he just gassed his daughter. But yeah, he was a bit of a loner. He was very quiet. He kept to himself. He stuck out as a leader when he had to. And otherwise, he was kind of just doing his own thing. He didn't want to take on anybody unnecessary. He was a bit broken in terms of mindset. He had had... what was it? His brother had gotten attacked right in front of him.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's seen some shit. Yeah. And,
well, and that's when, like, she was like, oh, I thought you said, like, nothing bad ever happened. He's like, yeah, nothing bad happened to me. Happened to my brother. It's like, my brother died. I didn't. So nothing bad. Like, I'm still going. And I was just like, that's actually a really interesting way of thinking. I like that. Like...
well, yeah. I mean, if anything bad had happened to Riley, he'd have been the one who was dead.
Yeah. But... And I mean, well, and think about that in, like, a zombie... movie, like, terms, it's like when you have a character that go, like, when it has that thought process of, oh no, it's all me, it's like those characters always tend to have no drive, or they break down, or they buckle under pressure. And it's like Riley's just like, he knows what he's supposed to do.
He's cool. He has a job the whole time.
Yeah, no matter what. Even it's like when Cholo fucked up and just like one of the new
on the booze run,
yeah, on the booze run, one of the new hires gets bitten and ends up blowing his own head off because he doesn't want to be a Zed, and he turns around and Riley gives him shit, but he's just like, there's, it's one of those, like, he's kind of like a manager like a Starbucks or something like that that has an employee that just doesn't want to work or doesn't want to follow directions or doesn't, like, and he has to deal with that shit. Like, that's just kind of how it's just
to,
like,
to a point. But Riley generally kept his wits about him. He was pretty cool about it. I think it's just because Cholo was such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And naturally you cast John Leguizamo in that role.
Yeah.
The pest. So, but I liked that where they both were kind of loners, but they operated so differently. Like, Riley kind of just, he wanted to get out, and he wanted to go try to figure out what normal was supposed to be. Cholo was trying to figure out what normal was supposed to be, but he had his ambition set on moving in with, like, rubbing elbows with the movers and shakers. Because Fiddler's Green was where the rich people were, the celebrities were, that was the gut the life condominium thing that was built there. And it actually reminded me a lot of, remember that Cronenberg movie we watched? What was it called? It was from the 70s. It was the one with the slug thing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Yeah. The STD metaphor.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, that, yeah. Uh-huh.
But that's what Fiddler's Green reminded me of, was that high rise. Yeah. Because they had everything. That bottom floor was grocery stores and shopping and all the other stuff. And then it was.
I tried to block that movie out.
And it was the only thing Slither? For my. I think it was Slither, yeah.
Or something like that, yeah.
I don't remember exactly what it was called, but it was Cronenberg's first film, and it's bonkers. Ooh. So if you ever want to seek that out, definitely go do that, and then listen to our review of it. We did that like 3 years ago.
Yikes.
Oh, God, that movie was so bad. But I definitely had flashbacks to that movie watching Land of the Dead because the setup for Fiddler's Green was similar. And the ending was, the third act was the same, where the safe haven of that condominium was overrun by the monsters.
Yeah.
There wasn't an attempted orgy, but there were monsters.
Yeah. That would be a whole nother movie. So the thing that killed me about Fiddler's Green was the fact that there were stores and people were living their day-to-day lives, buying products and things like that. And it's just, a little part of me was just kind of like, one, how are you getting those products to the point where you
like
now...
Like keeping the shelves stocked?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's because, yeah, I mean, you could go out and have these people make these crazy runs out to these stores and stuff. But now, these richy-rich people are now buying these products because, one, it's like, are you buying it because that's just, you need some type of way of, like, that's how I used to live.
And right, that's you want just, your normal stuff.
Yeah, it's like, they're trying to be normal, they're trying to do this, like there's other stuff where, I think one of the majority ones that you see is people eating and a server. So someone is working in Fiddler's Green, and they're serving, like, drinks and like, high-end foods and stuff like that.
But it's in a world where money's meaningless.
Yeah. And that's where it's, like in Dawn of the Dead, yeah, when Flyboy and Peter are in the bank, and they go and they hold up the money, and they take the awesome picture. Like,
yeah.
Well, that's like, it's like, yeah, it's like, money, like, what is money gonna matter? And at... Or even in Day of the Dead, when they're talking about how you get all these records and you get all this, you know, all the floods and all the stuff with the Fortune 500 companies, like, all that shit doesn't matter anymore.
No, it doesn't. And you know, in a post-apocalyptic world where trade means more than the consumerist side of things, where you're actually using fiat currency back and forth, you saw that with Riley and Mulligan. Was his name Mulligan? The Irish dude?
Yeah, I believe his
Mulligan. Yeah, his son was Roderick from Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Yeah.
I forget the actor's name, but I just remember him from Diary of a Wimpy Kid that he did like 5 or 6 years after this. But anywho, Riley had brought antibiotics to Mulligan to take care of his son because his son had gotten sick. He had an infection or something. And naturally, because it was fucking antibiotics, Megan. And so
my brain was also trying to pick up what you were saying. I was like, oh wait, yeah, what you say? I got you. Yeah, I'm now on that same train with you.
Yeah, it's just the ramblings of the sick. But that was what in that type of an environment is going to mean more. Like, you almost have to have, everybody has a set job, and you're going back to a barter system where one person has this skill, one person grows this, one person does this, and everybody kind of has to be like, all right, well, I'll trade you X for Y instead of using currency because it has no value.
Yeah. I mean, something where it's like, oh, it's like you just go in, it's like, oh, I just got I just snagged a pair of like Air Force One, you know, Jordans, you know, like the first, like stuff that's like super expensive. It's like in a zombie apocalypse, it's like,
it's fucking meaningless. At that point, it's like, it's sneakers, dude.
Yeah. It's, and so seeing that where these people are just living this lavish life and money still means something to them. I mean, what's his name? The head of Fiddler?
Kaufman.
He, at the end of the movie, when he's kind of trying to make a run for it, shit is, like, hit the fan, things are just going bad, he's like, I gotta get the fuck off of this little island of mine, I can start up a new area, like, you know, get new, he goes, I can get new investors, and it's just like, he's still talking as a businessman, and he's still going, and on this, that same train, but then he ends up going down into the vault and just grabs as much money, paper money, as he possibly can. Nothing, there's, like, I think he has a gun. But it's like, that is, like, his, the most important thing is for him to go, I'm going to grab all this money and then take it off of this island with me.
And that's, and that was another point, that was the third point Romero was trying to make in here is, I actually think he might have accomplished it better in this than he did Dawn of the Dead, is the consumerist,
yes,
the anti-consumerist idea. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying I'm a capitalist. I believe in fair trade, open markets, the whole bit. Now, I do not think widespread consumerism, buying for the sake of buying, because I'm also a minimalist,
yeah,
to a point, buying for the sake of buying is a good idea either. So what Romero has done, because he has created his own class in this movie with the Fiddler's Green, you have the upper class and you have the lower class, and class, the normies, that you see Riley moving about in this market.
They're the ones living on the streets.
Yeah.
And like, just in shanties and...
But they seem to be functioning better than, yeah, the Fiddler's Green people. But they don't, again, if they're going back to that old trade barter system, and Fiddler's Green is still using money. But the problem with fiat and paper currency is the value only exists based on what you're willing to place on it. That's just like anything. That's an economics lesson. It's only valued at what someone's willing to pay for it. Well, the paper money in a post-apocalyptic world has no value because it's useless. They're people without homes. There are no jobs. Like, it has no purpose. So to show that, and I guess this is the fourth point that Romero had put in this movie, everybody's trying to find what normal is. The Zeds are finding normal. The people on the street are trying to find normal. And then you have the group in Fiddler's Green, where they are trying to maintain that version of normal that everybody knew. We buy stuff, we come home, we have jobs, we've got this, you know, these routines, and money is at the core of it all. And that just shows the difference between, say, like, Riley and Kaufman, because when Kaufman is, like, it's an emergency, he's going for the cash. Riley, he's just trying to get the fuck out.
Yeah, he's going for his car.
He's going for a tangible thing that will be useful to move him along. And then, but it's just interesting to see these three men in Cholo, and Cholo is trying to move up in class, and Kaufman won't let him.
And that is another thing where it's seeing just I don't know if he was trying to do this or if it just kind of happened, but it's like seeing the class of people where it's, you know, just the layers where it's like zombies, streets, high-rise people. Mm-hmm. Like, so you just see those tiers, and Cholo just being this whole, like, I've done enough dirty work for this man. He owes me, you know, so much money, and he's like, I can't wait to get in there. Like, there's one thing where when Cholo goes on the booze run, and he goes and gets, like, a really expensive, you know, case of, I believe it was a wine, or it was champagne. And there, Riley says something like, oh, like, well, you know, you're just gonna, like, you can't get that much money, you know, from it, and he makes, like, some comment like that, and then Cholo's like, no, like, my friends are gonna, they'll pay high dollar for something like this. And I'm like, I can understand where so these Richie Riches that have all this money, and it's like, I wonder how much money they're actually spending, because from what it sounds like is guys like Cholo and you know, whatever, you know, crew that kind of runs with him that, you know, can go and get, they do these runs for liquor and stuff to sell basically like on a black market type of thing.
That's basically what it is. Yeah. They use it for trade and then it's some black market stuff to the upper crust. They're probably the ones supplying the restaurants in Fiddler's Green, for all we know.
Yeah.
So they're selling the whatever they find for top dollar. And it sucks because Cholo even mentioned, he's like, he owed, I think Kaufman owed him 20 grand for one run, and he'd owed him money for other runs.
I thought it was like 80. Like, I thought it was 80 grand total or something like that.
Yeah, but he'd owed him 20 grand for like one run.
But then he was like, oh, it'll give me enough to come and live up here. And I'm like, well, first off, it's like, one, I live in this world. I know how it is where it's like, you make a little bit of money, you give a little bit of money, and then you have to go and work to get said money. Again, you don't just, oh, I got 80 grand, and then I'm just going to just live like a fat cat the rest of my life.
Well, he thought that would that was going to pay him out cash for one of those condos or something. But what are, that begs another question. So you have all these guys running around doing these raids, right? They're running for supplies, they're looting stores, the abandoned stores and stuff like that. What are the people in Fiddler's Green doing? I imagine they're independently wealthy to a point, but that, if you're not, there's no stock market. They're not making money. There's not investments being where you're earning percentages year over year. What jobs are they doing that they are able to maintain this lifestyle and not piss everything away so quickly?
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's like, okay, so if they're paying Cholo and these guys just you know, a good amount of money for, you know, booze and stuff like that because they're risking their lives, and it's just like, yeah, I mean, maybe these are like the billionaires. These are the, you know, Donald Trumps and the you know, the Mark Zuckerberg. Like, so these are the guys that are like, we got money and we don't give it two shits about what we do. You know, they don't have that kind of care in the world. But it's just, it's one of those things where that money goes very, very fast. And on top of that, it's, so did they just all decide to collect all their money and put it into this one bank on Fiddler's Green? So
that's the only way that would work.
But it's like, how do they get their money? If they got millions and millions of dollars, like, these are the Richie Riches.
And what is that money? If they're all living in this one space, to use a social argument here, what good is their money?
Yeah.
It's all coming and going and cycling in and out of literally the same space.
So, I heard you guys were talking about the money thing. So, Kaufman, the guy that was in charge, the millionaire, whatever. So, he created a mini economy. So, he sponsored Dead Reckoning, right?
Mm-hmm.
He sends that out. He pays them for it. The people that go out filter that money back into the economy. And everybody that lives in that Fiddler's Green pays Kaufman to live there. So, the money is just goes in a circle. So, it's whatever money he had in the bank, so he was already, you know, a millionaire to begin with, or billionaire, whatever. So he literally just created a mini economy inside of there. The money's only valid in Fiddler's Green because they don't know if anywhere else is, you know, if anybody else is working on the same system. So that's how he keeps control of Fiddler's Green. Because the only money that gets put back in the economy is the money that he pays the guys that go out. They come back, they spend it. It's the same idea that they tried to do with the military at one point. They pay the military puts that money into the economy, and then the military charges the economy to operate. So this works in a circle. It's pretty genius. And it's exactly what would happen if there was ever any type of dystopian reality.
It's just, I never saw it as like, how does money come
in? And the reason continued to use the money, even though basically money was worthless, is because it's something that everybody could recognize.
Yeah, it was normalcy.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that's all it was. But I heard you talking about it, and I was like, well, you just created a circle.
Yeah.
He cut out the government and banks and just turned himself into
that
money. All of the above?
Yeah. That's all.
He was always interested in money, and he was but he was more interested in class and making sure that.
Well, that's why he wouldn't let Cholo in.
No,
even though Cholo had the money.
Because he was just the dog that was running the, you know, running the errands and things like that.
I think Kaufman might have been mildly racist too, because he would have let, if Riley wanted to live there, he would have let him.
I think so too. I just,
because Cholo was riffraff, but he was also Latino.
Yeah, and I felt like there was definitely touches of that as well, because yeah. Like with Kaufman, like his driver was black. His driver was fucking awesome, by the way. Like,
oh, he ran away.
See you later, Mr. Kaufman. Like, yeah. He fucked right off.
But like the way he treated Cholo and Riley, basically did the same job, right? But the way he treated Riley was treated almost not quite as an equal. But close. He spoke to him as if he had respect for him. He treated him a bit more equally. But with Cholo was his errand boy. And he treated him like his errand boy.
Yeah, I think Cholo had this, like, he had that mindset of, I'm going to do this to get in with the boss.
Oh, sure.
Riley was just like, I'm just here to watch my own ass. I don't give a shit about you. And I think
it was that Office Space mentality.
Yeah, and I think Kaufman saw that in just the way, the demeanor of the two. I don't think that...
Well, Cholo reeked of desperation, so that doesn't help.
Yes, and I think that's what... If Riley gave an ounce of, I want to go to Fiddler's Green and live up there with you guys, I think Kaufman would have been like, okay, you seem like you could fit. Because of just your demeanor and the way you present yourself and what
and you're white.
Yeah.
Everybody that lived in Fiddler's Green was white. Just about.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure they
I'm trying to think back to like
I'm
a lot
sure
of the
they
scenes,
had
but...
room I'm sure they had rooms for the help. I mean, I'm not.
Well, and that was the thing was like I'm pretty I feel like there was a bunch of different, like, different ethnic groups and stuff like that in there, but I'm trying to think back, because, like, a lot of the shots that you saw of Fiddler's Green was, it felt like a commercial. Like, it felt like
the commercial they were actually running in the movie.
It felt like a JCPenney's Black Friday sale commercial, where it was just, like, or, like, a Forever Rocher, like, it was just... I don't know. Like there was just so much that it didn't feel real, or it just felt like something that was like that you would see just, you know, on TV type of thing. But it was just I don't know. Like the thing with Riley and Cholo, like we were saying, like just having them being the dog and the an actual errand boy type of thing. I like that he had that mentality, he had that drive, like, I want to get to this point, I've been working really hard, and now you're not letting me in. You basically told me no, and said that I'm not a good fit, there's no way that I'm ever... He didn't even say that, oh, you're not going to come up here, you're not a good fit. He wasn't going to pay him the money.
Nope.
And that was also... Like, I don't know...
He promised, he backed out on a promise payment. And regardless of whether money means anything in this world or not, when you are doing a job in exchange for something, the other party needs to hold up their end of the bargain.
Yeah. And that was something where I think that Cholo had more like oh, really? That like we're really doing this, because it wasn't the money portion of it. It was the whole like I want to live here, and now you're not going to. So I was like, I don't even think the money thing ever really popped in his head.
Well, because in his head he was like, well, we can just stack up the IOUs and use that in exchange to get a condo.
Yeah. Now what was funny was that he ended up stealing the best fucking weaponry everywhere. For fucking zombie killing.
Yeah.
Dead Reckoning. This big ass tank.
It was a homemade tank.
Oh my god, it's so badass. But, so they took Dead Reckoning, stole that shit, and then took it up, and they were going to go up on top of this hill and point missiles at Fiddler's Green. Then they said, okay, cool. You don't want to give us a high rise. You don't want to, you know, pay me my money. Cool. I want $5 million shipped across the water.
Or I'm blowing this shit up.
I was like.
Yeah, especially in a place where there is no government. There is no overseeing body. I mean, maybe in places like Fiddler's Green, yeah. Which Curtis had mentioned, where, like, you have the one guy in charge. So, yeah, Kaufman would be the governing body of Fiddler's Green. It's its own little country, I guess. Yeah. You could say it's its own little sovereign place that suddenly gets overrun with the Zeds. I don't know.
Yeah, that was, I don't know, with Fiddler's Green, it was just seeing how Kaufman could, and again, you also got to give that guy a lot of credit in a way for what he ended up doing, because just taking that whole structure of, I'm going to take all these billions, I'm going to make us a safe haven, I'm going to get these people to come in and be a part of it and understand that, oh, you want to live the way that you do, that's awesome, and then we're going to be able to restructure how everything, you know, functions, and just that way we can still keep our way of our high-end way of life, and then everyone that's on the outside, it's just one of those, it's the gatekeeper, it's the, you don't fit our way of life, so that's it. And there was a good amount of people that live within Fiddler's Green, but there's also a lot of people, like, I almost wonder, it's like, how do you, would it be better to just work in Fiddler's Green? Or would it be, I mean, obviously living in it would be better, but, you know, because you don't have to do shit, you're just there. But it's like, if you know that you have something, you're working, you're doing something within, within, you know, Fiddler's Green, it's like, you kind of have some type of purpose. And it's, instead of being on the outside, on the streets, having to deal with all that shit.
Actually, I feel like it would be the opposite. I feel like if you're trapped in Fiddler's Green, you don't have a purpose. You're there because you have this, you want the illusion of safety.
That's what I mean. It's the illusion of safety where it's like, you know that there's chaos and shit on the outside because they're running.
They've traded freedom for safety is what they've done.
Oh, I mean, the whole thing is fucked. But I'm saying, like, when you have those, like, dingy back, you know, backdoor bars where they're running zombie, I don't know, like,
basically cockfighting.
Cockfighting, but with zombies. And then they're, like, and there's, it's just, it's a slum and it's just dirty and it's just not safe, and you really have to have a really, really thick skin to live in a place like that. So, again, it's one of those, like, if you're trying to really save your own ass, and you could be inside Fiddler's Green, not having to deal with the shit on the outside, it's like, in that instance, like, do you, like, would that be a little better? Or, I mean, again, the whole thing, it's...
No, if you want from my headspace, my perspective, no, I would not want to live in Fiddler's Green. Because you're under Kaufman's thumb. And you've given up for the illusion of safety and normalcy, you're giving up everything else. And while, no, it's not exactly safe living out on the streets... What has become the middle class, I guess, if you want to break this into a class system, you have the lower class, the Zeds living in the ghetto. You've got the middle class, which are the Raiders and all of the people that are living in essentially the Hoovervilles, the shantytowns. And then you have the upper class, the upper crust, in Fiddler's Green. I'd probably want to take my chances outside of that place, because the thought of Fiddler's Green was creating their own prison is really all that they did. They built their own prison. They wanted to make sure they got their three meals a day. They had a warm bed. They were, you know, behind lock and key. the outside world can't come get us in here. They gave up everything for the illusion of safety that that place provided. And that's all it was an illusion. That's all it would ever be. But humans have this incredible knack to convince themselves that this is... we have this amazing ability to convince ourselves of just about anything. And it's like, oh no, I'm safe and secure here. No, safety and security are illusions 100% of the time. And they fooled themselves into locking themselves in a high-rise building, which, if you think about it logistically, there's really only a couple ways in and out of. And the higher up you go, the harder it is to get out in case of an emergency. And they've boxed themselves in.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, the electric fences. Because you watch, they're surrounded by military, and you watch the Zeds hit the electric fence.
And they think, fry.
Yeah.
It's extra crispy.
And then the soldiers just shoot them. And, okay, fine. But that is enough to give the people living in Fiddler's Green a peace of mind, and it's false. I mean, we saw that at the end because it took one Zed with problem solving and cognitive ability to go, I think we can make this work, and take out the people that were hurting them. And it's like you mentioned it earlier with Big Daddy and the Butcher, where he found the wooden wall and he felt for a weak spot and then told Butcher start hacking. That's all it took.
And I love too with Big Daddy in that scene where he looks through the hole and then the zombie swings by him and then he looks in and he sees that it was target practice range.
Yeah, he was not happy. And
it just fueled that fire even more. He just gave a loud roar, and that was just—it was fucking go time. He was like, "I've had it."
He had all he could stand, and he can't stand no more.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like that. Like this one is interesting as far as the way that is set up with. I guess you could call it with this section of just a zombie story, and. I like that the characters themselves actually were pretty interesting. I mean, one of my favorites is Pillsbury. So, Dead Reckoning has been stolen by Cholo and his guys. They take it off, and like I said, they're going up on top of the cliff, and they're about to fucking rain down hellfire and hot metal all over Fiddler's Green. And so, Kaufman gets Riley, Charlie, and Slack... Okay, Slack. Basically, to go out and find Dead Reckoning. Well, while they're doing that, Kaufman also sends out the investors send a military escort with Riley to help him out. And they get this short little firecracker of a woman, and then this big fucking hunk of a man just
called Pillsbury. The big Polynesian dude.
Yeah. If we're going to do something, let's do it. Fucking right. Dude, like, that dude is awesome.
Talking about how all these cars are stolen on the island of Samoa.
Yeah.
And there's only that many cars on the island.
Yeah.
And I was like, get out! Stop it!
Dude, like, that guy was fucking awesome. And then I love that it became a thing where... Obviously, Riley was just like, Kaufman sent you guys to make sure I don't come back, right? And the lady's like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like,
Pillsbury,
okay.
And Pillsbury was like, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Pillsbury was like, oh, I gotcha. And he's like, fucking knocks her ass out. And then he's like, and I love that Slack looks at Pillsbury, and they just kind of this moment of like, we're bros now.
Yeah, but there was an understanding moment
like,
there.
We got you. Yeah, like, let's go do this. Go team.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, but Pillsbury, man, he was fucking awesome. Like, so that, like, there was stuff about it that was, that I liked. There was another little scene that was really cool where I call him... Oh, I think his nickname is Mouse. Cholo puts him on this dock and tells him to wait for the $5 million from Kaufman.
Yeah. Oh, the young guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Which... So, for me, if I'm by myself on a creepy dock in the middle of the night, I am not listening to music.
No, God, no.
That was the dumbest fucking thing.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like to put the fucking headphones on, cover it, to completely cut that off, and to not really be aware of your surroundings and what's like. I was like, oh,
seriously.
My God. Like, yeah, by yourself, no, that is not Dummy. Happening. And it's like, and for me too, it was like, oh yeah, Cholo just left him by himself. I was like, why didn't you just leave him and another guy? You know, it's like somebody that could, you know, be there with him to watch it. Because what would be the thing for this kid, if he's like really caring about money, to go, oh yeah, okay, yeah, they sent over the $5 million on the ship. And he's like, okay, I'm just going to take, like, a whole bunch of this and then go away.
Right.
You know, like, what is Cholo going to...
What's stopping him
from doing
that?
Yeah, Cholo's not nowhere near. It's like, he's just going to just sit here with his money and then wait for, you know, it's... Like, there. I don't think the kid would have had the balls enough to do that. But, again, it's one of those, like, you're just... The plan, I don't feel like, was that...
Nope, that wasn't terribly well thought out, no. I don't think, either. And then... I want to wrap this up here in a minute, but the ending. Cholo's ending. Where he got bit on the hand. And it was just such a... I actually kind of felt bad for him. Because he just wanted something better. And his methods kind of sucked to get there. Like, he was not a good human. But, like, he genuinely just wanted to do something better with his life, and he gets bitten. And it's like, oh, no. But what cracks me up is he goes, well, because he contemplated killing, like, he waffled on the killing himself thing. And then he goes, no, I'm going to use this. And he, while he still has all of his faculties and he's still alive, he marches his happy ass over to Kaufman's office. Okie dokie.
Well, the best part about that was, like, so he gets bit and he's just like, God damn. He's like, you spend all this goddamn time, you know, making sure that you're okay. And all of a sudden, you know, that one moment you get bit and his, I guess, you know, counterpart, like, you know, the guy that's working with him, he turns around and he's like, you know, do you want me to do it? Like, that's, you know, he's asking, he's like, do you want me to shoot you?
Yeah.
He's like, doing stuff. And he just has that moment of, no, you know what? I kind of want to see how the other side lives. That's the first time anybody's ever said, you know what? Nah, I want to be a zombie. Like, that's cool. Like, that'd be...
And it's literally just because he wanted to get at Kaufman.
I think that drive for Kaufman was always there. And that's where I was talking about how it's... Like, how fresh of a death is going to affect their brain function and things like that. Because... When Kaufman is down in the parking garage and he has this big run-in with Big Daddy, right?
Yeah.
And Big Daddy, you know, gets the gas pump, shoves it into the front of the windshield, kicks on the gas, and I'm like, that is terrifying because it's like, one, Big Daddy's got the gun, so Kaufman can't just get out and run.
No.
Because he knows, like, because Big Daddy's actually already shot at them. So he's in this car, just and he can't go anywhere. And then when Big Daddy leaves after shoving the thing, Kaufman just kind of has that moment of like, oh, that's just, you know, it is what it is. And then, you know, it's all over. Guy's gone. I'm good. But then all of a sudden you hear this like thing whiz by Kaufman. And then you realize that it's Cholo's weapon of choice, which was a spear gun.
Mm-hmm.
So... Cholo,
which was an interesting one.
I like the idea for it, but I don't feel like it's that practical because it's...
I mean, you can collect your you can collect your ammo.
Yeah.
So it saves in that regard.
Well, that's why, like, you know, like the Daryl Dixon with the, you know, crossbow and stuff like that. Like, crossbow seems like it would be more of a, like, a more functioning thing. Yeah, because, yeah, you could just reuse your weapon, or, you know, your ammo when you, mm-hmm. when you can. But that was the thing, was, like, so we see the spear gun with, you know, or from Cholo, but then Kaufman turns around and he's like, oh, like, I can't believe, like, you're here, you're, you know, can't blah, blah, blah. Given that whole bad guy soliloquy type thing. And then Cholo comes into, like, out of the shadows. Oh, no, Kaufman shoots the shit out of Cholo a whole bunch of times. And then he thinks it's all done, and then Cholo gets up and...
Yeah, no, not really. Yeah,
and he's, like, complete zombie. But it's, like, he went, like, rot, like, real quick. And that was something where I almost feel like, obviously they did that just for that big dramatic...
Oh, the big reveal, yeah.
The big reveal, the big, you know, so, because, like, he just died, but a little part of me was like, I kind of would have liked it not to be so zombie. Like, if that makes sense, because he's freshly dead, so he doesn't have time to rot sag or to look... Like a caveman, like he's all, you know, dead, sunken eyes, yeah. Like his skin's like you know, hanging down.
I hear you yeah. on that. But I also, it doesn't bother me because you need to have an identifier.
Yeah,
that's all, and that's all that is.
But that's where I think like having like something like the Dawn of the Dead stuff, where it's the zombies look just like normal. Like take John Leguizamo, but just like give him like. You know, the bag, like, the dark, you know, shading under his eyes or something. Like
make him more, like, waxy and ashy looking?
Yeah, like, so, I mean, just kind of give him a different type of makeup, not literally, like, I was half expecting him to, like, him open up his mouth and he's got, like, the rotting teeth already. And it's just like, what?
Oh, okay, I see. I hear you.
Yeah, because, like,
too fast.
Yeah, like, with Big Daddy, it's like, he had, like, mongoloid teeth because, like, his teeth were completely rotted out and just, you could tell, like, it... I was like, for that man, it's like, if I had to picture him pre-zombie, it's like, is he going to have those teeth?
No.
No. It's like, most of those zombies, like, they weren't going to have those set of chompers. And so, like, with John, like, you know, with Cholo, it's like, I almost felt like it was done just for the dramatic effect of seeing him as
oh, said. For sure.
And it was awesome, but because he was a great zombie. But at the same time, it was I like him a little bit more fresher because it just happened. So I don't know.
But overall, though, the makeup effects were great.
Fucking boss, they're so good.
Yeah, they were fantastic. No complaints on any of that. I think. It was all super well done. There were a couple things like here and there, but generally speaking, I thought the makeup was pretty good. The cheerleader was really the only one I saw that I was kind of like, you almost stuck the landing.
Yeah, but then she got hit in the face with a flagpole.
Yeah, that's true.
So, one thing that I've always wanted, and because we mentioned it before, but with like Bub, I would love to see a Bub movie. Like, yeah. I want to see, like, what happened to Bub? Like, did he ever get out of the bunker in Florida? And it's like, or what?
I mean, we're led to believe he was, but that's a great question. I would like to know that.
I mean, like, that would be something where, even if it was, like, a comic book or something, I mean, if somebody made that, that'd be awesome. But that would be cool. Or even do, like, a bunch of the zombies that were throughout these movies, like, what happened to Big Daddy? Like, did they just go off and survive? Like, did he... I don't know. Like, it'd just be cool just to see kind of a what happened after type of thing. I know they did that for Shaun of the Dead. It was kind of like a quick... thing like the bonus features where they were like, okay, well, a few of the characters, like, this is what happened to them afterwards, and they were like a little quick sketch kind of just panel type stuff just to explain
what right
like what's the what's her name's what's the friend's name
I don't know, I'm blanking on it.
My brain is completely... The
girl from space, right?
Yes. There's a whole bit where it's like because her boyfriend ends up getting ripped apart, mm-hmm. like Captain Rhodes, and then she grabs his leg and starts beating the shit out of zombies, like screaming at him. And there's like a whole bit where it's like she beat so many zombies to death and was able to get away and then climbed up a tree and then stayed there until cleared out. Like, so they kind of like explain like that, and then she got down and then kind of lived her life with, kind of as normal as it possibly could be. But
right, whatever
it was
that means.
Yeah, it was just that whole thing of like, oh yeah, she made it out and then survived by beating the shit out of people with a leg. Like, so I don't know. But the bub thing and even Big Daddy, it would be really cool. And also, it's like, I almost would have felt it would have been really cool to see a bub cameo in this film. Like, that would have been, you know, just having, like, just bub, like, in the background.
This is a nice little touch.
Like, that would have been really cool. Just to see. But, I'm all for it. So, I'm ready to give some skull ratings if you are.
I am. I think totally.
We made it through with the Ramblies. Hey, didn't you used to have run a podcast called The Ramble On?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were good at it. John especially.
Holy
bananas.
Woo!
So this one may come as a surprise to everybody, because up until last week, I quite liked the Night Of remake. But really, this one was the first one I watched where I was like, huh, hey. This is pretty good.
We got a movie here.
I think we got something. I saw this before I met you. I had a boyfriend who was zombie obsessed. And I had seen this once before with him. I think he owned it. And, or this might have been a drunk blockbuster night. I can't remember. But anyway, I had seen it with him. But I have vague memories of, like, some of the shit Big Daddy got up to and whatever. But I fell asleep during most of it. I think we ended up watching it, like, super late at night, and I just passed out. So I didn't see the whole thing. So really, this was kind of a first watch for me. But I think the ideas that Romero was playing, like, you know, kind of sum up here. The ideas that Romero was flirting with in the prior three of the Dead films, he did much better here. I think there's a lot more to it. I know this movie gets shit on a bunch by of the Dead fans for some reason. I'm just beginning to think they don't have any fucking taste, or they don't like a story with their story. That's really the only thing I can get out of this. But I quite liked it. I thought this was pretty well done. I gave this one a 3.6.
Nice.
Yeah. The Zeds looked good.
That's pretty high for you. Yeah.
It is, considering I don't like these... generally don't like zombie movies. I quite liked the makeup. I loved the Big Daddy character. I think he was fantastic. I like, and I'm glad Curtis came out and explained the whole economic cycle of Fiddler's Green. I liked that there were, like, three or four different ideas that Romero built up on. There's a lot of layers to pick apart here. A lot of shit going on. A lot of it you have to think about. But there are enough clues and breadcrumbs to actually build out some really cool ideas. And I think this provided a really good template for what would come a few years later with The Walking Dead. So 3.6 for me. I quite like Land of the Dead. I'm curious to see where the next one goes, because I've never seen it. Ever. So yeah, let's I'm gonna be
I think this is gonna peak for you. If I have to put my money on it, I think this is gonna peak.
Oh, well, way to wager, I guess, gonna be cautiously optimistic, but now
I'm hoping that you're gonna sit there and go, you know what, no, like, I like, it makes sense, but it's like, from, I think this was like at the kind of the end of it, because then everything goes, you know, straight to video, and I don't think it gets the same kind of love and things like that. I think there's a couple of touches of like what we were talking about with Romero, just kind of pushing forward. It's been years since I've seen both Survival and Diary.
You must have watched them without me, because I've never seen them.
Yeah, but I mean, it was just like, it was one of those, I must have not just thought they were that great, because they just, I don't remember any of it. I think I maybe a still or like a zombie scene, but again, I've seen so many zombie movies that they just kind of, I was like, I could.
Well, one of them just appeared out of nowhere. It was whatever the last one was before he died, Diary of the Dead.
Yeah.
Like, it just randomly appeared one day.
Yeah.
Like a year or so before he died, and it was like, where'd that come from?
Like a fucking zombie that came out of a down in Dead Reckoning, the half zombie.
Yeah, right.
How fucking awesome was that?
That was, as soon as I saw it hanging onto the back, I was like, well, that's not.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's coming back some point. and then Pillsbury just like throwing it the fuck out of the thing. He's like, all right, let's go. It's
like, so what's your skull rating?
All right, for me, I also like this one a lot. Not as much as I do Day, but it's definitely up there for me.
It's close.
The zombie, as you said, the zombie look and the feel of just how, you know, rotted and just everything's bloody. It's just, everything was good for me. So, I also like that there is a story to be had. I like that there is those social constructs and just how things work, and just seeing that, you know, Kaufman had this ingenuity to take this whole structure of just money and just get it to literally funnel through and cycle through so that there could be some type of functioning life or society. It's like, so that is really cool to see. I mean, like, it's still a little funky for me, because I'm not very savvy with money like that. So it's just like, for me, I was expecting it to be like, oh, like, how are you guys getting money from the outside world into, like, to keep that things filtered? But the way that, you know, Curtis explained it, where it's, you know, you filter it through, it goes into one, you know, portion of your government or whatever, and then gets cycled around, and then comes right back in and then filters up again. So it's like, it's just constant. So I love that. But then having just that, like, I wish a motherfucker would moment with Big Daddy, and just, he's had enough, fucking awesome. So for me, I ended up giving it a 4.2. So it is a lot of fun for me. I love the lore of it, but it's just one of those. Well, I'm just going to give it a solid 4. It's a solid 4. The 4.2 is mainly because of the zombie look and the feel of the movie itself. But the more I kind of think about it, it's like, it felt like it had more of a, I don't know, like a dystopian, like, feel, where it's like almost like a Mad Max kind of feel.
Well, yeah, it's all right? Post-apocalyptic thing.
Yeah, yeah. So for me, in those, like, the zombie movies, I think I gravitate a little bit more towards the ones that are a little bit more grounded. So, like, Night of the Living Dead is one of my favorites, because it's literally just in a fucking house and zombies coming at you.
Sure.
This is like, I don't know, like, there's, for me to sit there and go, okay, you guys have a complete military, and then you guys get fucking owned by these zombies, and it's just like, and like that big ass truck, Dead Reckoning, it's like the fact that you guys could, you just, it's a massive tank, and it's like, how could a zombie survive from that? It's like, there's no way that, like, you should be able to survive in that big ass fucking tank.
Well, that's the rub, is they didn't survive.
No, I know, but it's in the hands of the right people, it's gonna get the best results, type of thing. So I don't know, like, it's really cool, but yeah, I'm gonna give it a solid 4. Super enjoyable, love it, and I do recommend this movie for zombie people, or, you know, people to introduce into zombie lore.
I think this is probably one of the most palatable and watchable of the bunch.
Yeah.
I think that's good. That's
I don't think that it deserves as much dislike. I don't think there's hate, but...
Oh, no. There's plenty of fans out in the interwebs that shit the fuck all over.
Yeah, but, and I don't think it deserves that kind of spoil at all. I mean, there's a lot of bad out there, but this one, it's like, no, it's enjoyable. I can watch this really anytime. It's, you know, I'm not like rushing out to watch it as much, but I mean, it's one of those, like,
you're not going to turn it off if it's on.
No, I'll watch it all the way through. 100%.
Cool.
Good shit.
So that's it for Land of the Dead. Pretty good marks all around.
Yeah.
Join us next week as we do... I can never keep them straight. Survival of the Dead.
Okay.
The problem is both of these movies snuck in under the radar, so I have no clue.
So, I'm going to put this onto your plate.
Oh, dear God. Please
don't. This, we may or may not. So, surprise for next week. We might be making this a double episode.
We did talk about that.
Yeah. So we might be doing a split Survival and Diary of the Dead review into one, depending on how quick we, you know, or how much information we're going to be able to get into this episode. Usually our episodes go about
hour and a half,
you know, 2 hours, you know, depending on how good the conversation is. But for this one, it's like, I don't want to make it feel like it's, you know, bogged down, or it's going to be the same stuff, or it's like, maybe we don't have that much to talk about with them. So maybe there is a possibility that we are going to do a split episode.
Do them both.
And that way we'll crank out the rest of the, and then we'll do our
wrap up
Romero wrap up review, you know, on the franchise. Sounds like my hound dog.
Literally.
But yeah, so that might be an idea. If not, I mean, hell, we might get into the episode and be like, shit, we got a whole another 2 hours and we're good to go. So
we'll figure that part out. But it could potentially be a double feature. So So if you liked so far, subscribe, and we'll be in that in your podcatcher next Tuesday. Yeah. Facebook and Instagram, Creep It Real. REEL as a movie reel. The emails, creepingitreal.cm@gmail.com. And don't forget, we has the merch. So hit up our Redbubble page, creepingitreal.redbubble.com, or hit the link in the Instagram bio to buy some sweet-ass merch.
All done by me.
Done by Lunchbox.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so proud of himself.
I am. I like my designs.
He's the goodest boy.
Yeah. We actually use that in Pokemon.
Just being the
every time we put out a Pokemon card, it's like, oh look at that Dewgon. He's just the goodest boy. You go do your thing, Dewgon.
All right. So until then, I'm Mr. Smeg.
I'm that good buddy Lunchbox. And I promise you, we won't be so loopy next time.
I promise nothing.